And tonight on Coast to Coast, we talk about the boom, how fracking ignited the American energy revolution, changed the world. Russell Gold, our special guest, he is the senior energy reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Stand by for this Coast to Coast ride. Now, we have an Instapoll going on for you at coasttocoastam.com. So if you're by a computer or you have your smartphone with you, get up to our website and vote with the big question. Are you in favor of fracking? Now, before we get into our special interview tonight with Russell Gold, this is what we've got so far. 50% say no. There's too much uncertainty about its effects on the environment. 40%, almost 41% say yes. It's been a boon to the U.S. economy. It reduces foreign oil dependence. And then you've got almost 9% undecided. Let's see if these numbers change throughout the course of this interview. You can track that along with us, our Instapoll at coasttocoastam.com, right there at the highlight reel. And all of you who are capable of just getting to your computer or you've got your smartphone with you, go vote. Go vote right now. Russell Gold, of course, as I mentioned, is an award-winning investigative journalist at the Wall Street Journal. He started his career at the Philadelphia Inquirer and at the San Antonio Express News. Back in 2000, he joined the Wall Street Journal. He covered Texas and economics before switching to energy. And in 2010, he was part of the Wall Street Journal team that covered the Deepwater Horizon explosion and oil spill. What a mess that was. And he earned a BA in history from Columbia University in 1993. Please welcome Russell Gold to Coast to Coast. Russell, welcome.
George, thanks so much. It's an honor to be here.
And by the way, a great job with a book, The Boom, explaining fracking, first of all, to a lot of us who really don't understand it. I mean, it's something that you hear about, but people don't really understand it. So we're going to get into that, too. But great job on that, Russell.
Thanks so much. By the way, your poll that you're running on the web actually tracks very closely what the national polling I've seen. It's really close. About 50% of people usually are not in favor of fracking, and low 40s are in favor of it. So you're perfectly tracking the national polls right now.
And it'll be interesting during our interview as they get more information from you on fracking to see if these votes change either way. So we'll track it together, Russell, and see what we're doing. Hey, I wanted to ask you this, too. Wall Street Journal, always been a favorite newspaper of mine. Are you seeing, because I used to work for the Pulitzer family at the Post-Dispatch, right, at their television station years ago. What a great newspaper it was at the time, Russell, but now it is so thin, I can't believe it. Are you seeing that around the country because of the Internet with newspapers?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're right. We are seeing newspapers thin out. And it's not so much the Internet, it's the death of traditional advertising. That newspapers are usually as thick as we have ads for. So if you get an extra bumper crop of ads, we'll fill it with more news. You know, we'll grab it from the AP. So as more ads migrate away from print, as readers get a little older and fewer people take the newspaper at home, you have fewer advertisers, and that's causing the papers to get thin. And it's unfortunate. It's just where we are right now.
Well, it is unfortunate, and I hope to God newspapers stay strong, because we need reporters like Woodward and Bernstein and folks like you who go out there and do a great job uncovering these. Because as much as I've been in mainstream television and radio practically all my career, Russell, newspaper people are different animals. I mean, they're better investigators. They have more time to concentrate on a story, where most people in television, and I can honestly say this because I spent most of my career in television, most people don't have the time or the resources in television to do the kind of investigations that you need.
We have the luxury in a lot of newspapers, and the Wall Street Journal is one of the few newspapers left where you do have the luxury to take a couple days to really dig into a story, to tell your editor, I'm not going to be filing anything today. I'm just going to be asking a lot of questions and trying to figure out what's going on. So, yeah, I hope that those type of news gathering organization continues. Be great if it's in a newspaper, but if it's in a really good website, I'm agnostic on that. As long as news gathering continues, I don't really so much matter what the format is.
You're in one of my favorite cities where you reside, of course, Austin, Texas, and our great station there, KLBJ AM, that we are booming away at down there when you're there. Austin's a great city. How did you get – were you born in that area?
No, I was born in Philadelphia, actually my folks own a little bit of land, and we can talk about this later, up in north central Pennsylvania, which was right in the middle of what turned out to be the Marcellus Shale, an enormous gas field that's being fracked right now. But no, I wandered down to Texas in the mid-90s for no particularly good reason other than I needed a job and the San Antonio paper was hiring. And it looked like a good and interesting opportunity. And I've sort of been going up and down I-35 ever since, San Antonio to Austin, to Dallas, and then back to Austin.
How did you end up being a senior energy reporter? How did you make that switch?
Well, I was living in Texas, as we were talking about, and, it's a classic love story. I fell in love with a Texan, and we decided we were going to settle there and raise a family, and I was looking around, and the Wall Street Journal only covered a small number of industries from its Texas bureau, and I could have covered airlines, I could have covered Walmart, or I could have covered energy. It was a pretty easy choice. I wasn't interested in Walmart or the airlines. The energy just seemed so much more interesting. People taking big risks, trying things, international. It was so much more appealing to me.
I would like to, Russell, to use you as one of our news guys once in a while. Whenever there's a breaking energy story, I'd love it. We're constantly looking for ways to increase our resources. So, we'll talk about that down the line. But
sure,
this wouldn't necessitate a lot of time from you at all. But if there's a breaking story, I'm sure you'd be on it. And, Fukushima would have been one of them, I think, at that time. We could have chatted about that. But give us your definition of fracking, because not a lot of people know what it is or even understand it.
It's pretty simple. What you do is you drill a well straight down, go straight down vertically, and then you turn that well horizontally. So it's like a J, basically. And you run the well through this incredibly dense rock. Usually it's shale, but there's some other tight rocks out there that people are fracking. So you've got this well down there, and you open up a small section of it, maybe 100, 200 feet, and then you pump in liquid. And mostly water with some chemicals and a lot of sand. And that's sort of your mixture. That's what they call the frack fluid. And you pump it down, and you've just put extraordinary pressure on it. This is the best way I can describe it. If you've ever been in a swimming pool and you're in the deep end and you swim 6 or 7 feet down and you feel your ears start to feel pressure. Well, now imagine sitting on the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, 12,000 feet deep, and all the pressure of all that water on top of you. That's not even the amount of pressure that these companies are putting onto the rock. They're just using incredible horsepower to push that water, that frack fluid, up against the rock. And water sort of, I never realized this before I started researching the book, but water doesn't compress. It doesn't get into a smaller area. So when you push what is basically 99% water up against a rock, something's got to give. And eventually what gives is the rock itself. And you cause the rock to fracture. The water rushes into all these new little fracture wings, and then it carries the sand in, and then you take the water out, and the sand stays behind. The sand props open the cracks so that the rock doesn't just close up again. And what you've done is you've created in this rock, just thousands of square feet of new cracks throughout it. And that's important because there's oil and gas in these really tight rocks. And if you drill a well through it, you're only touching just a few square feet of this rock, and maybe a few molecules will move out of the rock into it. But if you create all these little fractures everywhere, well, you know, this is how nature works. You want to create a balance. It wants to go from the high pressure to the lower pressure. Oil and gas will escape out of the rock into this new low pressure cracks, flow through the cracks, around the sand, and into the well. And that's really what fracking is that you're just taking it's a big brute force to crack up these rocks and free up oil and gas molecules.
So you're really squeezing the very last drop out of whatever area you're drilling.
Well, you know, George, when you say last drop, you couldn't be more right. Shale is where oil and gas was created. It's where millennium ago, the little zooplankton and phytoplankton, these tiny microorganisms, they all died. And eventually that was turned into oil and gas because you put enough rocks on top of it, enough pressure, enough heat, and it cooks these into oil and gas. I mean, that's why we call them fossil fuels. We don't call them fossil fuels because they've got dinosaur fossils. This is old microorganisms that have turned into it. And, you know, for millennia, what we did was, you know, if you go back to the Mesopotamia, the hanging gardens of Babylon, well, we built that, humans built that by using bitumen, oily dirt that was there at the surface. We began by using what was at the surface, then we dug a little bit deeper and we got some natural gas, and then we kept digging deeper and deeper and deeper. And now we were looking for pockets of oil and gas that maybe escaped out of the shale over time. Well, now we've gotten to the source. We've gotten to the kitchen where it was baked and created. You can't go any further than that. We can't figure out a way to drill even deeper because, well, we could go deeper, but there's no oil and gas down there. We've gone down, and we are now getting oil and gas out of the very place it was born.
Yeah, I've got to have you on one day because, Russell, I'm the old abiotic oil theorist, and we'd have fun chatting about that.
Yeah, we could talk for a while.
But you know what? I'm the kind of interviewer. You have your due, but we're here to talk about fracking and why you believe it's so important, and that's the important thing. This is not going to be...
Well, let me just put it this way. That is what I believe. That I believe that that's where oil and gas started, and that's how it came about. But there are others with other opinions. I'll give you that.
Now, with this fracking, so they're squeezing, as we said, the last drop out of this. Where's the controversy? Why are so many people upset with fracking?
Well, let me start by just saying that this is what people are worried about. They're worried that this activity is going to contaminate water, and they're worried it's going to contaminate the air, that you're going to have pollution.
Okay.
They're worried that it's going to cause earthquakes. I mean, they feel that this is just a very dangerous environmental activity. So that's maybe the simplest answer for it. The more complicated answer, and I struggled with this because I'm trying to figure it out myself, but the real fracking activism, the fractivists, as some of them call themselves, really began after 2008, 2009. And that was the time, if you remember, where the United States Congress really debated whether to put a price on carbon. We were going to have cap and trade. Mm-hmm. We were going to put a price on carbon. We were going to get serious about climate change. And the environmental community was very supportive of that. And it didn't happen. Not at all. And they came out of that very frustrated. And they looked around, and here was this new rising technology to increase the amount of fossil fuels, to increase the amount of oil and gas. And they turned to it and they said, you know what, it sort of caught their attention and caught a lot of their frustration. So that's sort of the two ways to answer that.
And while we continue talking about fracking, our latest poll results here, our Insta poll, 52% say, with the question, are you in favor of fracking? No, there's too much uncertainty about its effects on the environment. 41% say yes, it's a boon to the economy, and we've got 7% undecided now, so those numbers seem to be holding. I sound like I'm announcing a presidential election or something. So-and-so
yeah.
Will have enough.
Which way is Ohio going?
That's right. They're going that way. So is there that much oil and gas extra oil and gas by fracking?
Yeah, is that we can talk, you know, until the cows come home about the environment, and there are all sorts of uncertainties there. But one thing is absolutely clear. There is an enormous amount of oil and gas left in the United States. We thought we were running out. We thought we didn't have very much. We were importing more and more oil. We were making plans to import natural gas. The conventional wisdom was the United States was played out. You know, we really got going on it right at the beginning of the 20th century, and we had done such a good job that after 100 years we had gotten it all. You know, boy, were we wrong. We just completely got it wrong. There is an enormous amount of oil and gas left in the United States in these tight rocks, in these shale rocks. It's staggering. We don't exactly know how much, but we're clearly talking decades worth of oil and gas.
Wow. And that's just by the fracking. We've still got untapped reserves that could last God knows how many years.
Well, we certainly have a lot. But, you know, let me just caution you about one thing. A couple of years ago, you would hear the industry talk a lot about we have 100 years worth of natural gas.
Yeah.
And they would come at that number. They would figure that number out by saying, okay, how much natural gas do we estimate is out there? How much do we use a year? And they would divide. I mean, it was a real simple mathematical equation. But anytime you find so much of a particular type of energy, and the prices go down, we're going to figure out ways to use more of it, and we're going to use it up more quickly, and that's already begun. So, yes, we have found a lot of oil and gas, but, you know, let's not fool ourselves. This isn't going to last forever. It's a great opportunity, but it's not going to last forever. We're going to find ways to use it, and we already are. Now we're talking about exporting. We're talking about building, petrochemical plants to use it. There's all sorts of new ideas coming out and ways to use this bonanza of gas.
And you know, Russell, regardless of whether we believe in the abiotic oil theory or the fossil fuel theory, I think we need to get away from oil as an energy source and get to something else. Is the industry looking at that, whether, again, it's going to be nuclear? Who knows? But are they looking at another alternative, or are they continuing to just keep pushing oil?
Well, the industry, if you're talking about the oil and gas industry, by and large, they know what they're good at. They're good at finding oil and gas and bringing it out. And you listen to them, you talk to folks like Exxon, and they'll say, we're going to be needed for decades. We're not making any changes. You do see some around the outside, on the margins, right? I mean, many listeners might remember a few years ago, BP tried to rebrand itself as Beyond Petroleum. Well, and the big French oil company Total bought a big chunk of a solar company recently, SunPower, I believe. So we're seeing a little investments in alternatives, but basically these companies look at alternatives and say, and that why should we give up producing a fuel that provides 50% of our energy needs and switch over to a fuel that's 1%. And I'm exaggerating somewhat with the numbers, but that's how they look at it. They just don't think that the transition's coming quickly enough that it's worth their while to make the switch.
When they start to do fracking, do they do it from the get-go when they're pumping oil? Is it part of the entire process, or do they do that much later?
Oh, no. The wells, once you drill a well into, let's say, the Bakken Formation in North Dakota, or the Eagleford down in South Texas. These are two of the big shale formations for oil. If you drill that well and say, okay, we're going to open that well up and let the oil flow, you'd be lucky to get a few barrels. Nothing's going to come out.
I see. All right,
until
hold on,
you
Russell.
Frack
hold
that
on.
Well, nothing happens.
That's what does it. All right, we're going to come right back. Russell Gold with us, his book, The Boom. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. You know, Captain Kelly Sweeney, who was just on with me in our news segment, talking about that Korean ship that had flipped, 300 people missing, 8 already dead. Sad story. But he's going to be my guest on Beyond Belief this weekend in Denver when we tape the program for a future show. So you can go ahead and sign up to watch those programs, 10 days free, by going to this website, beyondbelief.com, www.beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, Russell Gold with us tonight, author of The Boom, Wall Street Journal senior energy reporter. So by fracking, they do it from the get-go, and that basically makes that well much more efficient than Russell, doesn't it?
It's not even just efficient. That well wouldn't work. You know, you know, it used to be if you drilled in and you accidentally drilled into shale, you could get a pink slip, you know, because it was, you just wouldn't do anything with it. It was inconceivable. That's how dense this was. Inconceivable that you could do anything with this rock. And slowly, you know, the industry figured out how to do it, and that really turned the corner.
What's going on around the planet, Russell, in terms of energy consumption? Are we still using the lion's share of the world's energy?
U.S. uses about a quarter, about one out of every four barrels of oil in the world. China obviously is growing very quickly. India is coming up behind. What's really been interesting over the last few years is that if you look at Europe, Europe's been pretty steady and, in fact, declining. That's such a mature part of the world, and they've been so invested in energy efficiency and other, you know, kind of related public transportation that they're actually using less energy now than they used to. The entire world is getting a little bit better at using energy more efficiently. You know, we get more gross economic output per barrel, but you know, we're still, the U.S. is still the biggest consumer by far. But I'm sorry, you know what, George? I apologize. China actually uses as much as we do. U.S. by far is the largest per capita.
Per person, okay. So but China's coming along. They'll probably pass us up, don't you think?
Well, no, China will clearly pass us up in terms of overall energy consumption. On a per-person basis, no, I can't see that happening. And I'll tell you why. Because if every person in China used the same amount of energy, oil and gas and electricity that people in America do, we would have to double globally the amount of energy we're coming up with, and we just can't do that. That seems to be impossible right now.
Since we've been doing this poll, Russell, let me tell you, since we've been doing this poll since you've been on, the gap is narrowing. With the question, are you in favor of fracking? The no's are now 48%. The yeses are 45%.
So okay.
Maybe
yeses are coming
people.
Up.
They are.
Well, I'm just telling people. I mean, look, I'm not pro or con. I just tell people the way I see it. 10 years reporting on this.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. Now, with regards again to the world's consumption of energy, how long? Let's assume you're correct and that we've got a finite amount of oil left, let's say, in natural gas. How long can we continue at this pace before we run out?
Well, you know, I see things a little bit differently than other people. I don't believe in peak oil. I think what's going to happen and where our real limit is not how much oil's there, but how much can the world produce. You know, we're at 91 million barrels a day. And to get there, we've had to just deploy billions and billions of dollars in some of the most complex engineering projects in the world. And we're really sort of pushing up against our limits right now of what we can do. You know, for instance, in Kazakhstan, in Asia, there's this giant project there called Kashagan, an enormous offshore oil project. And it has been so complex that they've spent $50 billion so far, and they've gotten nothing out of it. It now just went into another two-year delay. It's been in the works for 10 years. I just am not sure how much farther we can push the system. Can we get to 100 million barrels a day? Yeah, maybe. But can we get to 125? I'm just not sure I see it. It's just getting more and more complicated, more and more difficult. So I think our limits are human in engineering more than oil itself.
Would you be surprised if in 20 years the rate increases and we're still pumping oil and gas and there doesn't appear to be any end to it? Would you start questioning the fossil fuel theory and start thinking maybe toward abiotic?
Yes. Yeah, you have me back in 20 years, and if we're not hitting limits, either human or what's in the ground, then I will definitely rethink where I'm coming from. Because, you know, that's what you have to do. You can't be married to your, you know, to your ideas. You look at the facts as you see them. You come up with your theory, with your idea. And if the facts change, then, you know, time to rethink things.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, back to the fracking for a moment. One of the things you said is they put in chemicals with the water, and people are concerned that those chemicals are contaminating their water, aren't they?
Right.
What chemicals are they putting in there?
Well, I mean, really, it's two basic things that you're putting down there. You're putting out a lot of biocides. You want to kill off the organism so that they don't hitch a ride from the bottom up to the top. You know, the bottom of the well up to the top. But you're also using a lot of friction reducers. You're using soaps and other things to slicken the water. Because you remember, I was talking about millions of gallons of fluid being pumped into the well under extraordinary pressure. Well, that creates a lot of friction, and it creates a lot of energy to have to pump it in. So you do everything you can to reduce that friction. You know, look, there is some really nasty stuff, some stuff you don't want to be drinking in the chemicals. It is a small percentage, but it's there. It's not really all that much different than what you find in another industrial operation. The big difference is that if you go to a factory, well, that factory is there. It's going to be built in a certain place, and one hopes at least that they're going to build in the proper safeguards. When you talk about fracking, you're going to build a frack pad in one place, you're going to do your business, and then a month later, you're in a different place. You know, you're building factories and then taking them apart. So it really takes a lot of extra caution to make sure that these chemicals don't spill on the ground. And also, and this is really important, that you're building the wells right, because you're drilling a hole across geologic time. You're connecting rocks that you know would take millennia for water or something to flow through. And you're creating a hole right through it, and you just absolutely need to make sure that the well is properly built and that chemicals or salt water or natural gas isn't coming up the outside of that well and leaking into these shallow aquifers. That is critical.
What, if anything, is the so-called fossil fuels doing to climate change?
Well, you know, we need to sort of break this down.
We're in a cycle. I think we're in an Earth cycle. It's going to happen anyway.
Well, so let me kind of tell you where I come from on this. You know, you're probably going to disagree with me, but I'll follow what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change will say. And, they're very concerned. They believe that we're putting too much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Here's something I can tell you, that this is, we know this. This is what the U.S. government says. 4 out of the last 5 years, the U.S. has emitted less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than the year before. 4 out of 5 years. I mean, that's something Europe can't say. I don't think there's certainly no major economy in the world that can say that. So how did we do it? Well, we found so much natural gas that we're burning a lot more gas and a lot less coal. And, burning gas emits a lot less carbon dioxide, about half as much as with coal.
That's true.
So if you want to keep the lights on, and I think most people do, using gas instead of coal is a great way to emit fewer less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
I would not eliminate coal altogether, would you?
I would use it in a very limited basis. It's a good fuel. It's inexpensive. But, in some ways, and I might get into trouble for saying this, I think its time has come. It's run its course. There are other fuels that are more efficient. They just work better than coal. So I think it'd be good. It's good to have it. It's a nice backup plan, but it's not something I'd really deploy first and foremost. It's just, if you assume that there's even a small chance that climate change is real, and that burning fossil fuels exacerbates it, then you want to get away from coal as quickly as possible.
Other countries doing fracking, or are we alone?
You know, other countries would love to do fracking. And, you know, if you look around, you look at places like China and Poland and Russia, Argentina, they're starting to do it. But there's a reason why it's taking a long time, and it's not been particularly successful. There are a couple reasons. First reason is we have drilled thousands of wells in the United States. We have a pretty good handle on what the geography is like underground. We know where the rocks are and what the type of rocks are. You start drilling other places. You start drilling other places, and they just don't have the same understanding. But there's another big, big difference in the United States and the rest of the world, and that is that in the United States, landowners, by and large, not all the time, but by and large, own the mineral rights. So that when a company comes and says, we want to drill on your property, there's going to be a negotiation. They're going to say, we're going to pay you $5,000 per acre for the right to do that, and we'll give you royalties. It creates an incentive for the landowners to say, sure. You go to other places in the world, and the United States is unique in that way. Everywhere else, it's the government that owns all the minerals underground, and minerals including oil and gas. And local communities are just, they're very upset about it, and they're resisting it, and they're saying, well, what's in it for us? We've seen this in China. We saw it in Poland. It's been a struggle.
Well, the yeses have now overtaken the noes in favor of fracking. It's 47.48% yes to almost 47% no.
The horse
undecided
race.
Have gone. So the undecideds are going yes with fracking. That's where they're picking up the votes.
Okay.
Interesting. Interesting takes.
Yeah.
Now, granted, though, you know, if you lived by an area that was fracking and you were afraid your water was going to get contaminated, it probably would be almost overwhelmingly no, don't you think?
No, I don't think that. I've spent a lot of time traveling around in Pennsylvania, North Dakota, and Texas, and it's not overwhelmingly against fracking. You know, you go to places, and you know what the number one complaint I hear overwhelmingly is about from people who live in this in frack areas where there's a lot of fracking? They complain about the trucks. You know, you go down to South Texas, these rural areas, and you just always hear, look, I used to be able to turn onto this road, and I'd drive 10 miles, and I'd maybe see two neighbors, and we'd wave at each other as we drove by. Now I can't even turn onto the road because there's a constant stream of pickup trucks. What people object to most and are most concerned about is this sudden industrialization, the sudden appearance of trucks and equipment and noise and lights. That's more than anything else. There are certainly people who are concerned about water, but by and large, that's not the primary concern because that's not been people's experience. Look, I mean, you've probably seen some of the documentaries and the TV shows, and you can put a panel together of people who say that they're, you know, very concerned about their waters or about their water. But I've been out there. I spent a lot of time reporting these places. People are concerned about their water, but it's not their primary concern.
You talk with a lot of engineers in your book, The Boom. Let's kind of digest the book for a moment, Russell.
Sure.
And go through it. What would you consider to be some of the key points of the book?
Well, there are a number of them in there, but one of the things I write a lot about is that there are ways to do this right. There are lots of ways that the United States can have an abundance of energy and still protect itself, and that's something we should strive for. I mean, that's sort of one of the overarching messages. There are a number of people in there. Another thing that just comes through so crystal clear in my book are the characters, the people who develop fracking, because there are just some amazing stories of inventiveness and of people just taking enormous risk to try to get this reward. And then a third big message that we could talk about is how quickly this all happened. That there were some very particular companies and individuals who pushed and sped up this process of going out and leasing and fracking wells. And really, we ended up kind of driving at around 80-85 miles an hour when it probably would have been more prudent to go 45 or 50.
Yeah.
And a lot of the problems that we've been talking about, a lot of the concerns people have, come from the fact that we moved so quickly and we drilled first and asked questions later. And we didn't, you know, we were 10 years into this boom into fracking before we started asking some real basic questions. You know, how much gas are we leaking? Are we building the wells correctly? Just such basic stuff like that. Can we use salty water as the basis for our frack fluid instead of fresh water? And the industry didn't stop and ask those questions because it was at such a breakneck pace.
Well, you know, this is also, I'm pretty sure, an environmental battle versus people who are into, you know, energy usage. And it draws those lines, too, and that's unfortunate, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it is, because I think almost everyone I know is concerned about both. Look, nobody wants to live in a polluted environment. We all want to live in a healthy environment, and we also all want a healthy economy. I mean, you know, I don't know anyone who says, you know, one or the other. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, if I were king and I could make all the decisions, you know, I could find a way to make really cheap energy if the environment was not a consideration. And I could find a way to completely protect the environment, and we'd have incredibly expensive energy that few people could afford. Neither of that's realistic. We have to find the balance. There's just, you know, we're sort of deluding ourselves if we think that we can't find the balance between the two, and that's really where we're going to end up and where we need to be.
Are we still importing a lot of oil and gas, or is that slowing down?
Well, let's take them one at a time. On gas, that's actually pretty easy. We never imported very much gas. We did from Canada, but outside of North America, we didn't. We were getting ready to. In 2006, we were starting to build import terminals. We were gearing up to import lots of it from places like Trinidad and Qatar and North Africa and West Africa. That never happened. On the oil side, we used to import 60 to 70% of the oil we used. We're now down to 40 or somewhere between 30 and 40%. And that's been it's continuing to decline. So we are importing a lot less oil than we used to.
Well, we're not relying as much then, are we?
Well, that's an excellent point. People are always saying, well, are we going to be energy independent? And I say, well, you know, I don't know if we're going to be energy independent, you know, in terms of being cut off from the rest of the world. I'm not sure if that's what we want to. But one thing I can tell you is that when you import that much less, you're no longer dependent on any one nation or any one region. We can pick and choose. You know, maybe we'll get our oil from here, maybe from there, wherever the price is right. And that's really where you want to be, because when you are dependent on one region for your oil, when you import so much, you need it from here and there and somewhere else, then your politics, your foreign affairs begins to sort of wrap around that. We need to stay on good terms with Saudi Arabia because we need their oil. We need to stay on good terms with this country because we need their oil. Well, we don't need that oil as much anymore. If Venezuela does something to upset us, fine. We can turn away from Venezuela. We can turn away from Iran.
That's right.
Get it from other places. That's the benefit of importing a lot less oil.
We still, though, Russell, politically want to take advantage, I believe, and at least, you know, run, operate, control those other oil fields out there, whether they're Iraqi, Iranian one day, keeping the relationship with Kuwait and Saudi Arabia.
Well, we certainly want to keep the oil flowing. I mean, that's sort of been a policy of the United States for years. We want to keep the sea lanes open. We want to keep the global trade. You know, a lot of that just comes from the fact that oil is the lubricant of the global economy, and if oil wasn't flowing, then the global economy, which the United States is a big part of, will have trouble.
That's true. We're going to come back with more with you, Russell, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about the boom.